This is the last in a series of 4 lectures on the lessons from the design of everyday things, or DOIT, by Don Norman. All right, so I just wanted to bolster up something from last time, talking about conceptual models. And I mentioned something about how users see and understand the system through these mental models, and how users rely on these mental models during their use of the system as well. So if you take a look at this knob that you have here, your interpretation of what the system is going to do is different if you, A, think that turning it to the far right enough turns it off, right? You know, one of those dunk, and there's a little detent kind of, and then it turns it off, versus thinking that you can press or click the knob to turn it off, right? So even how you interpret what the control is or what it's supposed to do is affected by your mental model of what is actually of your mental model, right? And because you are not actually, you've never used this particular knob before, you can see that your mental model of what this knob is going to do or is supposed to do is informed almost completely by your prior experiences with knobs that look similar to this one, right? And so there you have it. If you had the knob in your hand, you could actually probably play with it and feel whether it actually clicks when you press on it or whether you can turn it and have it click, right? And that would be developing that user model by actually playing with it. Alternately, I could tell you what it does. Alternately, you could watch me do it, right? So these are different ways that you can develop that mental model. All right, so let's just roll on then. Today, we're talking about last lessons from Design of Everyday Things. Next slide. So we're basically just going to be talking about individual differences. And so it'll be a bit of a breather from kind of all that really, really deep stuff. I'll take you on a bit of an aside to talk about intelligence quotients and the design of intelligence tests, just for interest's sake, mainly. So what I really want you to take away from this lecture are two main things. One is discuss the role of individual differences in design and describe a good rule of thumb and the consequences of that rule of thumb for design. And I want you to identify and discuss factors that make design difficult that are unrelated to design itself. Okay, so these are not things that you necessarily have in your control. Next slide. So question is, who should you actually be designing for? And I know this picture looks absolutely ridiculous, but I can tell you from personal experience that this is exactly the situation I ran into when I was visiting England, and that is why I don't live there, amongst other reasons. People there are generally apparently much taller, and so I need to aim up when I'm using urinals, which is a very unpleasant experience. So if you take a look at the next slide, so obviously on that previous slide, the urinals are too high for this little kid. On this next slide, you can actually see, you can ask the question, where should we actually put the mirror, right? Where should we put it such that everybody can use it? And in this case, the kid is too short to use this mirror. In the next slide, how tall should the door frame be so that people can actually walk through without hitting themselves, right? So who should we actually be designing for if you think about all these different situations? Right, you can see that there are obviously trade-offs no matter which way we go. So the problem, next slide, the problem, of course, is that people are all different. You know, it's rarely possible to accommodate everybody perfectly. And because design is a compromise, you're going to run into situations where people are going to suffer. Right, somebody's going to suffer. Standard ceiling height is 8 feet, but some of the tallest people out there are taller than 8 feet. Right, people vary. And here's the important thing. Not only do they vary physically, that's the easy thing to talk about, right? But they also vary in things such as how they perceive things, in terms of their cognitive ability, in terms of their reasoning ability, all these things, and their background knowledge, let's say. All of these things vary, right? So next slide. In thinking about who we should actually design for, one of the things that we sometimes think about is, how about we just take the average and design for the average? Well, the problem with the average is that that's not really good. If we think about height specifically, let's suppose people range from heights of, you know, say five, I don't know what, okay, people range from heights of, you know, 2 feet to 6 feet. So the average of that is what, like, I don't know, 4 foot and a half, right? Let's just say. That's obviously ridiculous, because if you were designing doors for that height, then half the people in the world would be completely screwed, right? So the rule of thumb is to design for 95% of the audience, right? Fifth or 95th percentile. So the problem with this, of course, is that notice that 5% of your population may be seriously compromised, but it's a typical rule of thumb. And so if you think about your cars and the height of the headrest, the seat size, these are designed for, you know, 95% of the audience. That's the idea. Computers and visibility, font size, line thickness, color for colorblinded people. These things are all designed for 95% of the population. That's the basic idea. So what I mean when I say 95% of the population, so if you click to the next slide, this is a Gaussian normal distribution, Bell distribution, Bell curve. You've probably heard of it under any one of those names. And if you stack up a lot of different things, it ends up that people kind of look like this. This could be height, weight, body fat percentage, blood pressure, cognitive ability, all of these things. People just kind of like distribute normally around this, around some mean. Two standard deviations out on either side gives you 95%. And so people on the top end of that and the bottom end of that are about 2.5% out of two standard deviations. And those can often be considered as outliers. So those are the people that are going to be severely compromised in any sort of design. If you take a look at IKEA instructions, next slide. These instructions are famously designed to be universally understandable by anybody with, I think it was like a fourth grade education or something like this. But I think what 95% means is up to you. Does it mean 95% of the local population, or does it mean 95% of the world population? You know, in many situations, we are designing software for a very specialized set of people, in which case, let's design for those 95% of those specialized people. So if you were redesigning PeopleSoft, for example, it's not necessary for you to design it in such a way that, you know, somebody that doesn't speak English or French could use this, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that you need to go out of your way to accommodate kind of what you think of as being extreme cases, right? On the other hand, you do want to make sure that you're accommodating for about 95% of your expected audience, probably. Next slide. One of the big problems, of course, is that you do not represent a good average user of the equipment or the systems that you design. You should not expect others to think and behave as you do, or expect them to behave in the way that you would like them to. People vary in thought and behavior just as much as they do physically, right? Due to life experiences, culture expectations, or whatever. So again, you are not in the group probably, and you need to design accordingly with that expectation. So that's a lesson that I keep hammering home over and over again, right? So when it comes to individual differences, they exist and people are quite varied, and you need to account for this when you design. The rule of thumb, rather than designing for everyone, is design for about 95% of the people that you expect to be using your system, right? So just as an aside, because I think it's kind of interesting, I'll talk about intelligence quotient. The intelligence quotient, IQ, this was developed in World War I, and the idea was to separate groups into groups of, you know, people that they brought in, that they recruited for training, right? So in principle, the idea is that you want your really smart people to be training for leadership positions. You want your kind of medium-level people to be training for, you know, partial combat and maybe partial coordination roles, maybe working communications equipment, that sort of stuff. And you want your kind of dumber guys to be sort of your grunts, you know, running on the ground, right, getting killed. And so the idea was you had this situation where you needed to do some mass testing. And so when they designed the IQ, the notion of IQ, they designed it as a bell curve with the average being 100. They designed it this way. And so if you look at this, this looks exactly like the bell curve from before. And these are standard deviation chunks, basically, right? So one, there's standard deviation on either side, gives you about 60, what is that? It should be 65, but That looks like 68% of the population falls between 85 and 115 in terms of IQ. Two standard deviations out, and you're covering about 95% of the population. And there is between 70 and 130. All right, so this was, it was designed this way. And next slide. So the assumption when they designed this was that this is innate. That is, you are born this way. It is constant. That is, that it never changes. And that the IQ is correlated with performance on everything, right? So you might ask the question, okay, so that's great. So how did they actually go about designing this thing? Well, they designed it in a way that probably seemed reasonable at the time, which was primarily with white English-speaking U.S. citizens. And the next question you might ask is, okay, well, how generalizable is this test? So if you hit the next slide, this is actually, if you want to have some fun, you actually try and fill out this question, this six-item IQ test. And I think for the most part, you're going to get, if you get more than 2 out of 6, I think you're doing pretty hot. The answers are right there. But you can see that this is obviously fairly problematic for a bunch of reasons. So if you hit the next slides, I think you'll see why. Early tests were clearly bound to the then current culture, right? White, urban, middle-class culture. So you had African Americans testing very poorly, non-English speakers testing very poorly, and obviously illiterate people testing fairly poorly as well. Since then, lots of interesting questions have been asked about IQ. So is there actually a general factor for intelligence? Are there different factors for different kinds of intelligences? Is mental age something that we should be considering? Is it actually heritable? Can you inherit intelligence? And is IQ actually fixed? Right? Does it change over time? Right? So in the case of knowledge, obviously it does. So the point here is not to say that these people that designed the IQ were dumb people. They weren't dumb people, but they were just designing it in a way that in the best way that they thought at the time. With the perspective of history, we can now say that there were some flaws in their methods. But nevertheless, I think that the point is here that you need to be aware that you're often making cultural assumptions in your designs as well. And you need to make sure that these are actually going to check out with the people that you expect to be using your system. Obviously, we can't account for everyone that is actually going to use our system, but you probably have some sense of who it might be. And so with those people, at the very least, you should check it out and make sure that it's actually working the way that you think it will. All right, so if we just move on to the next slide, we're kind of back into regular topic stuff. One way to think about it is you might actually be designing for a certain kind of experience or a style of use where you kind of have novices or casual people use casual types of computer users, people that are intermediate users or people that are experts, right? And when you're designing for these kinds of users, you might have different things at your disposal, right? So if you were designing for experts, you might want to make sure that you had shortcuts for power use, right? So they have keyboard shortcuts and it affords full task and customization, right? If you're designing something for novices, obviously it needs to be something that you can walk up and use. Instructions need to be very clear, and maybe there you'd want to provide a much more simple system image essentially to people so it's easier to figure out how to use certain systems. If you hit the next slide, I've got a screenshot here of the Tesla car dash that you see on the inside. And this is often what we're beginning to see, right? These dashes are like these cool, slick touch displays, right? But I'm going to argue that, in fact, this touch display requires far more cognitive effort to manipulate and control compared to, if you hit the next slide, this thing right here, right? And in some ways, this is an unfair comparison. I'll grant you that. But you can see here that, you know, each button has some tactile feedback. When you press it to change the radio station, like it probably goes in, the other ones all pop out. the knobs you can actually twist with your fingers without looking, kind of. If you go back to the Tesla image, you can see that this is something you're going to need to pay visual attention to, right? If you put your finger on the wrong place, it's going to actually do the wrong thing, right? So changing just the radio station is going to be very difficult to get it right. If you're thinking to yourself right now, well, I can change my radio station with a rocker that is sitting on my steering wheel. Well, that's fine, except for the problem is you're going to have to remember how many times you have to click it to get to whatever it is you want to listen to, right? If you take a look at that tactile one, that old kind of 50s style radio, you can actually feel, you know, five buttons over, that's the one that I want, right? So, yes, this is kind of an unfair comparison. The reason it's an unfair comparison is because the Tesla vehicle obviously does way more things with the dash than the 50 style radio. And this is one of the reasons why design becomes difficult, for reasons that are completely out of our control. So if you hit the next slide, the problem is that the machines that we are controlling are getting far more complex. The number of things that a person is maybe trying to control has increased dramatically. Displays are increasingly artificial. Rather than using physical ones, we are often using these digital ones, and they're flat. And so feedback is more complex, subtle, and in principle less natural, right? I think that often errors are increasing in seriousness and costliness, right? And if you think about this, this is just the way it is. It's probably unlikely to go back. We're unlikely to go back to simpler times, right? Unless you're a hipster, essentially. So if you move on to the next slide, there's also marketplace pressures, which are completely out of our control. You know, adding functionality which adds complexity is very cheap, right? It's easy to add a new feature, right? Just get another intern or another coder, have them whip it up, right? But this makes things more complex. Adding controls or feedback mechanisms is much more expensive. So let's suppose that the Tesla was actually going to put in some of these physical controls. Well, that's actually probably far more expensive than it is to have that multi-touch display there, right? Particularly if those buttons were to appear partway through the multi-touch display, right? And design usually requires several iterations before success. It's difficult to get it right the first time. This is the lesson that I've been trying to convey to you. And the idea is, rather than trying to get it right the first time, let's get it wrong multiple times really quickly so that we can hopefully get it right in the end. But the problem is, in the marketplace, you rarely get a second chance if it's a real product, right? The other problem is that people consider cost and appearance over actual design. And bad design is not always visible, right? And the other thing is that people often blame themselves when they run into these issues. So if you hit the next slide, the general problem is that, you know, when I was talking about affordances and stuff like this, I was often using images of very simple machines, really simple devices, a pair of scissors, a hammer, right? And these have often very clear affordances, and we know what they're supposed to do. The problem with our computational devices is that they can be used for just about anything, right? They do lots of different things, a general purpose. And so they have no natural conceptual model, and it's completely up to a designer to figure out how to figure out what this is and how to convey it with the system image. So these are some reasons why design is hard and why a lot of it is actually out of our control as designers. So next slide. In summary, many human errors are actually errors in design. We can provide help using a bunch of these things that we've talked about, right? Affordances, causality, constraints, mapping, positive transfer. We can try to design to accommodate individual differences, but the reality is that design is difficult for reasons that go beyond design itself. And that's it for this time. Thank you very much.